Committee on Judiciary, page 73, side 1. Thursday, May 24th, 8:30 a.m., Subcommittee 3, public hearing and work session on House Bill 20, excuse me, Senate Bill 329 and Senate Bill 893.
House Committee on Judiciary will come to order. The clerk will note those present remain or excused. We have before us this morning two bills, Senate Bill 329 and Senate Bill 893, and I believe we'll take those in numerical order. The people who are here on 893, I would imagine, will get to that about 9 o'clock if you care to. If you have something else you want to do, come back at that time. The first person signed up on Senate Bill 329 is Darrell Johnson. Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, I would defer to Chief Petrie if it's all right with the committee.
That's fine. Mr. Petrie? Yes, Representative Lombard?
Yeah, might I make some preliminary remarks on this bill just from here rather than going out front. The bill is originally introduced was a carbon copy of the Washington legislation, which was introduced, what, 2 years ago?
Yeah, 3 years ago.
3 years ago, to try to proscribe the area's responsibility between skiers and area operators and owners. The bill was introduced and sent to the Senate Agriculture Committee. Senator Kulongoski is a member of that committee. And after the initial hearing on the bill, I think it was the general consensus of all of us, including not only the trial lawyers, but people who represented, the attorneys who represented the skiing owners and operators, and Senator Kulongoski and myself, the Washington bill could be vastly improved upon. So, following that, the chairman of the Senate Agriculture Committee, Senator Hanlon, appointed a subcommittee consisted of Senator Kulongoski, myself, and then Darrell Johnson, representing the skiing owners and operators, and Clayton Patrick and Keith Swanson, representing the trial lawyers. We all met for about 4 different sessions, work sessions on the bill, and went through it rather exhaustively. What happened to Darrell Johnson went back, redrafted the law in essentially the form that you see it in now, and then we worked from that draft and had, as I say, substantial input from both the trial lawyers and attorneys representing the area owners and operators. So what you see before you now is the work product of that subcommittee, and that is what, of course, passed out of that committee and was approved by the Senate. That is the extent of my preliminary remarks. Go ahead with witnesses.
Thank you, Representative Lombard. Mr. Petrie?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Keith Petrie, and I'm the general manager of the Multiport Ski Bowl Complex on Mount Hood. I'm also president of the Pacific Northwest Ski Areas Association. We have been very supportive of this type of legislation because of the tremendous impact that the cost of insurance has had on our industry, and it seems to be going at a uncontrollable rate in both cost and the increasing number of suits that are being put forth against the various areas, and we think very much because of the very publicized case of Sutton vs. Mount Stratton about 3 years ago. And as a result, the number of claims against areas have increased 3 or 4-fold in this two-year, three-year period of time. And it's not that the area operators are trying to duck their responsibility or pass off their negligence at all. We are supportive of the bill in an effort to clarify the responsibilities of the individual skier, and it is in the areas of where the operator has no actual control over what that skier does and his day-to-day decisions while he's skiing.
Thank you. Excuse me, Mr. Petrie, I'm not familiar with the Sutton case you referred to. Could you tell me a little bit briefly about it?
It was a case that was... It ended in the awarding of, I think, $1,250,000 or award, and it was staggering to the industry, and it involved a controversy on grooming of the slopes, of how well a slope should be groomed, and the natural hazards involved. And the court did, jury did find in favor of the plaintiff in that case, and the very large amount, I think, looked very attractive to other people. It was actually an award in excess of what the plaintiff had originally asked in the complaint.
Where was that case from? Is that an Oregon case?
No, that's Vermont. And it just happened to get a lot of publicity, and we think it's had an impact. As I say, the main thing here is that we're trying to define those areas of responsibility to the skier where we have no control over his actions, how fast he goes on the slope, where he decides to ski, what running into other skiers, collisions, that sort of thing. As far as our own responsibility is concerned, we're very well heavily controlled or by the Forest Service and the what we call the ANSI code, the American Standard Institute Safety Code for chairlifts. And these things are set forth and there's no question about them. This legislation has been, similar type legislation has been passed in about 14 other states, is now pending in about 5 or 6. And coming back from our National Ski Area Operators meeting, we showed the people back east this bill, and they feel that this is one of the best bills written to date, especially recognizing the contributory negligence facets of our existing law.
Was there input from any of the skiers or ski associations?
Yes, we have two representatives of the Ski Patrol and one from the Ski Instructors Association, but at the Senate, every ski club in Portland came forth, both ski associations, the ski patrol, and there was something in the neighborhood of 20-25 witnesses, the Santa Am Ski Club, and it was very the full support of the consumer group.
The skiers testified in support of this bill?
Yes. There was no negative testimony from skiers to the bill. And we think that in the various work sessions that we have had with the members of the Senate committee, that we feel that we have reached a compromise situation. It's not all what we'd like to see by any means, and I don't think it's all exactly what the Trial Lawyers Association would like to see, but we feel that we have reached a good compromise situation, something that we can both live with, and therefore very strongly support the bill in its present form. I would say that at the present time, 75% of our premium dollars are going to strictly administer suits, and only about 25% is actually going for the final claim settlement. And it's very, as I say, this is a result of this tremendous increase in the number of claims against us, which most are being dismissed. And in the process of writing this law, we tried very much to, as I say, stay with the compatibility with the existing Oregon laws. And the one thing that we do feel is very much needed in there is the two-year, or is the notice requirement, simply because of the transient nature of our employees. And so just all we're asking is that if an accident does occur in the area, that we be notified in some manner, and which the Ski Patrol report is what we consider reasonable notice.
A few other questions. I'm not a skier. I've skied a couple of times in my life.
Well, then we'll work on you too.
I don't count myself a skier, but there are two things about this bill that concern me. Number one, it does set forth the duties of the skiers, and quite extensively. list a number of items here that they have to do, but I don't see that there's any corresponding duties of the ski operators except to give notice to the skiers of their duties.
Mm-hmm.
It strikes me that the ski operators should have some reciprocal duties if we're going to have a law of this nature. The second thing that concerns me about the bill is that it has a 180-day statute of limitations. And there are a lot of groups that come before the legislature which would like to have shorter statute of limitations because that's a way of limiting their claim exposure, because a lot of people, frankly, don't know about those things. Sometimes they're unable to comply with them, and has a way of cutting people off without a method of recovery for reasons beyond anybody's normal cognizance. We have a general 2-year statute of limitations for negligence, and people tend to rely on that. Even attorneys get trapped by these short statute of limitations because they crop up in areas where you don't expect them. So I find that aspect, those two aspects of the bill very troublesome.
I would answer it this way, and I think this is something that Darrell Johnson can address a little better than I. But first, the 180 days is only notice of the accident or of the injury. And this here, again, as I say, is the need for this is because of the transitory nature of our employees. For instance, that a suit of which you have no is filed a view of which there is no accident report, no knowledge of the area where someone may be hurt in the area and then leaves it without being attended to by the ski patrol. And we have no knowledge of that accident until, say, 4 years later. It's very difficult to put together a defense in finding all your employees of the particular day and situation, because, as I say, number of college students gone in the Army, long gone. It's very difficult 4 years later to reconstruct.
Representative Mason.
I have a suit now against a trucking company that I'm representing a plaintiff on. And in that particular case, the trucking company now can't find its employee. But would you suggest a similar 180-day statute of limitation for trucking companies who hire pretty casual labor like yours?
If this is a continuing showing forth, I would say that it ought to be given consideration, because it is very difficult to put these situations together. I think the ski areas probably run a more transient type labor than most industries, which is very typical of all recreation industries.
I'm just wondering why the ski industry, and incidentally, you say it's just a matter of giving notice, but line 15 and 16 indicate that unless the 180-day notice is given, no suit can be maintained unless there's good cause for failure to give notice. I'm just wondering why the ski industry should stand in any different shoes than the other businesses around the state. Thank you. Or anyone else who operates a motor vehicle or any other activity which subjects them to lawsuits.
Well, I think we are bringing forward to you one of our problems that is affecting us and asking for specific consideration in this area. It would be very difficult for me to talk for the other industries of which I'm not knowledgeable.
Yeah, I think everybody would like to have one of these 180-day statute of limitations if they could get one. The hospitals would like them, the doctors would like them, the lawyers would
Well, I think there's a difference between the claim and just the fact that you have been hurt. There was an injury, for to give us the opportunity to investigate the circumstances within a reasonable time to clarify the what did happen. And there is a provision there, as you say, in line 15, that unless there's, you know, some circumstance, justifiable circumstances, which of course is something that can be put to the judge or the jury at that time in filing.
Would you say that if a person was injured and because they were generally aware that there's a two-year statute of limitations, they didn't contact a lawyer for 180 days and then found out that they couldn't bring their lawsuit. Would that be good cause?
No, well, it does. The bill also provides that the ski area operators shall give notice of skiers of their duties under Section 4 of this Act in a manner reasonable calculated to inform the skier. So we do accept the responsibility to post this, and I can tell you exactly what will happen in all the areas, that of these responsibilities, notices will be put in primarily the ticket sales area. So, it, as I say, we're not trying to duck out from under it, and we'll go to the extreme efforts to notify people of what the law is. And this has been done in the other states, as far as that goes. If I could address your second question, too, there is another law, and here, Darrell, Mr. Johnson would have to give you the statute number, but there is another Oregon law that definitely says that we will adhere to the ANSI code and operate American Standard Institute safety code for the operation of aerial tramways. And all of us on forest land are under very strict inspection procedures of the Forest Service. We're living under this code at the present time, and that law in a sense defines our responsibilities, and it was just a matter of not being to have a very simple, clear bill here and not reiterate those things that are covered in the other legislation. And that's been on the books for 12 to 14 years. And I might say that actually Oregon does have a very excellent record as far as injuries themselves go and accidents within ski industries, but it's this problem being plagued, and we're looking at what's happening to our costs. And it's just not the cost of the suit, but once one is filed against you, it takes a tremendous, as I say, when you start tracking these things down, it takes there's a cost to the area that isn't really recorded.
How many lawsuits have there been brought in Oregon against ski operators, do you know?
I'd have trouble, but over what period of time?
Say in the last 5 years.
I would say only about, well, those that have been settled outside of court, I don't know, but I would only say five or six that have gone to court.
And how many?
And I'd have to ask Darrell about this one. I couldn't pin it down that exact.
And how many of those cases did the ski operator prevail, and how many did the skier prevail?
I think the ski area operator has generally prevailed in most of them.
In any of those in which the skier prevailed, what was the maximum judgment that's been obtained?
Right now, I'm just trying real hard to think of any that the skier has prevailed in. I think Mr. Johnson could answer that one a little better as he's researched it.
Yes, Representative Mason.
Do you have any guarantee that should this bill pass, your rates indeed will go down?
Only in discussion with the insurance company, but the thing is, we're not so worried about them going down as we are not going up. And yes, because the insurance is based on our loss record and the cost of administering the programs.
Well, it sounds like your loss record's been hasn't been too bad.
That's correct, but as I say, 75% of our dollars have gone into administering claims in which the plaintiff does not prevail. And it's many in these areas which are covered by the inherent risk and the rules of the slope.
It seems to me that if in 75% of the claims the plaintiff does not prevail, then the judicial system and the law as it is now is working awfully well.
But it's awful expensive still, too.
Well, the purpose of this statute, then, is to essentially foreclose the filing of claims, and that...
Only in those areas where we have no control over the skier, primarily.
Okay, any further questions? Yes, John?
The thing that worries me in the bill, and perhaps I should not conflict my interest because I'm a fear, but I don't have to announce it because I'll get the vote, is...
We're recorded with respect to your question.
Okay. Policy statement says, no person engaged in such sport shall recover damages from a ski operator for injuries resulting from inherent risks. Inherent risks include bare spots, rocks, and stumps. Okay? Now here's a hypothetical situation. I'm the first person off Texas on a morning when there's 110 inches of snow. Skiing down, and I crash on a bare spot that wasn't marked. Should I be able to sue you? I'm not over skiing my ability or anything. Would I be able to sue you?
If you were not over skiing your ability, I would wonder why then you hit the bare spot. If you were under reasonable
control. Totally unmarked.
Pardon?
Totally unmarked. I was looking at the sunrise. I don't know.
Well, there you go. You were looking at the sunrise instead of skiing the slope.
All right, or I was looking 2 feet in front of me instead of 5 feet in front of me and didn't have time to.
Well, just like driving with your headlights, you should be looking, not skiing any faster than the area that you can see ahead. And if you're entering into areas that you don't see ahead, then you should check your speed.
So you don't think that you have a duty to mark the bare spot, even with those little bamboo poles or anything?
Mm-hmm. I think we would do it in an effort to. But the thing is, when a spot bears, say from wind, which can happen, all of a sudden the wind hits it, and then that crops up like that, and then all of a sudden you got a rock sticking up there in the middle of the day, and I've seen this happen a number of times at the meadows, too.
But I'm talking about being the first person off the chair. The only people who've gone down before me are the ski patrol, and hit all of a sudden, unmarked rock, 110 inches of snow, according to the weather report and all that, and the reports that you give out.
And you have skied Texas quite a bit.
Yes.
Okay, well then, here again, you know the terrain, and you know these things can happen.
But I expect to see some sort of warning.
Oh, what happens if the wind comes up in between the time? You know, you take a reasonable number of patrolmen, you know. They can't hit every spot on the slope.
Thank you.
I'm really dubious of Section 4 and putting this in statute. I find that putting... I mean, the next thing, why don't we put in statutes that when playing basketball, one shall not use an NBA hand check? What's the difference? Is this appropriate detail? Shall not cross the uphill track of any surface?
Yes, because that can cause a very serious injury to the other skiers as well, and you can have a derailment. Say as a palm lift or a T-bar.
Well, sir, skiers shall yield to other skiers when entering trail. This is Oregon revised statutes mm-hmm. you're putting this in. I have no quarrel with this. It's all very good, but this is Oregon revised statutes. Is next session is going to be water skiers? What they can't do in the statute? People are.
I think we should repeal the automobile.
Yeah, we have the thing in automobile and boating.
You equate automobiles, driving an automobile with skiing on a slope?
Yes. Very much so. There's a traffic problem.
To be very frank, my fear has been we've seen an incredible public outcry about there being too much legislation, too many laws, being government getting too involved in everybody's life. Mm-hmm. That's been the trend in the past year. It's been a very conservative, very... restrained trend, and then you want us to pass a law that's going to tell someone how to ski right down here at the Jot and Tittle. I think that's a little inappropriate.
Well, the ski in public, the consumer group, which if you were to read the testimony from the Senate hearings, and I said rather than belabor a long hearing now, we felt that testimony was adequate as it is in the records, and the consumer group is very much in favor of this legislation, is very much in favor, and we'll have representatives of the ski patrol and the ski instructors here, and I'm sure they will tell you the same thing, that this is what they want. They want to control the cost of skiing And I think that's another thing the American public does screaming for is cost control. And this is one very definite area that we can make an effort in this direction.
I guess I'd feel a little more comfortable about the listing of these obligations. And again, remember, I'm ignorant on this stuff, so it's just a question of how comfortable I feel rather than any great knowledge. But I think I'd feel differently if there was a listing here that said that the ski operators shall patrol the slopes, shall mark things, so on. If we're going to list the obligations of one side, why don't we list the obligations of the other? That's what I don't understand.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes?
I suggest we have Darrell Johnson come up and perhaps Rich Morton also. Darrell can cover a lot of more legal issues. One thing I would tell you that was brought out in testimony in the Senate, particularly out in the subcommittee, is that the ski area operators, in fact, are very restrictively regulated in terms of what they shall do under the terms of their permits in operating their areas. And Mr. Petrie referred a short while ago to some standards, American standards, that they have to operate. Those standards delineate in far greater detail their responsibilities than these do. They do not delineate in any sense what the responsibilities are or the rules of the road or rules of the slope are. Skiers. So it was our feeling in working this bill that the one thing that was needed to delineate responsibilities was a set of rules of the slope for skiers that really correspond with the rules that are required of the area operators. I think Mr. Johnson can also speak to the matter of the 180-day notice and how this was arrived at and worked at in the time change.
In closing, I will say we are not opposed to inclusion in this bill of controls and defining our responsibilities. It's just our thought that they are, but if the committee so choose, we're not in opposition to that at all because we're already doing it.
Well, as I said when I commented, it may be only my own ignorance. Yeah. You know, I just have to ask these questions to find out what the facts are in these cases.
The ANSI code, I will say, is a thing that is under continual revision method of which the government agencies, the Forest Service, the tramway boards are participating in, you might say, on a very current basis. And so it's a very involved book.
Thank you, Mr. Peter.
Thank you
very much. Mr. Johnson?
Chairman, I was going to say members of the committee, but there's only one other, so I'll say Mr. Chairman and member of the committee. I'm Darrell Johnson, attorney, Willamette Center, Portland, Oregon. I was retained by the Oregon Ski Area Operators.
Pardon me? Are you the firm?
Yes. Bolivar Bright, Leedy, Johnson, Pendergrass, and Hoffman.
Thank
you. 1000 Willamette Center, Portland, Oregon. A card. I was retained by the Oregon Ski Area Operators to assist them in the preparation of this proposed legislation. Prior to that time, I should advise the subcommittee. I have for the last 3 years, I guess, 3.5 years, represented the carrier that insures the ski areas in this general area. And in connection with that, I have had cases assigned to me where litigation has resulted. We tried a big one in January. It's the only one that I have actually tried in the 3.5 years that I've been representing the ski areas. All the others have been settled or, from a legal point of view, taken care of. So I have that background of experience. I appeared at the first hearing, as a matter of fact, at the second hearing on this, purely as a friend of the committee and a friend of the ski area, and the problem got quite involved from legal complexities, and that's why they asked me to participate in the preparation of the legislation. I probably came down here about 6 times, I guess, on work sessions with Senator Kulongoski and Representative Lombard, representatives of the Trial Lawyers Association. We had many hours of give and take and a considerable amount of compromise and discussion, so that what you see before you represents many hours of concentrated effort. I would like to explain a little bit of the background to the subcommittee. The Stratton Mountain case that was referenced a moment ago was back in Vermont, and the theory of the case was that this skier was coming down and caught his ski on a piece of brush along the side of the ski area. And Stratton Mountain had advertised in its brochures and so on that they had the cleanest and best groomed slopes in the United States, or words to that effect.
I'm sorry, sir, he caught his ski on what?
Pardon?
He caught his ski on what was it?
On a little brush at the side of the run. So right after the incident occurred, some other people went back up and they couldn't find the brush anyplace. When the case went to the man ended up as a paraplegic, as I recall. And when the case went to trial, the defense was on the philosophy that the brush wasn't there. And obviously the jury found that it was there. The opinion that came out and the decision of the case appeared to negative the idea of assumption of risk. Now this is the key to this whole case, is assumption of risk. And so this Stratton Mountain case went up on appeal, was affirmed, $1.5 million verdict on it. And it was touted all over the United States as being the destruction of the bastion of assumption of risk. If you examine the case very, very carefully, as Representative Lombard has and myself, I don't think that it really ends up in that kind of a declaration, but that's what it was expected to be.
Was that brought on negligence theory, or was it have something to do with the representations that they made about
the... Well, that was part of the trial, that we represented, or they represented, that this was the cleanest slope that there was, when actually there was a bush over here, but nobody could find the bush. Before that, there was a case in Vermont called the Wright case, or known as the Wright case, and that had been followed in the United States for years, that skiers assume the inherent risks of skiing. And that's the way that the cases had been tried for many years, what few cases there were. This case supposedly upset the apple cart. And immediately, the insurance companies started raising their rates, not on what was there on the books at that time, but what was coming next year and the next year and the next year. So they have had this effort by about 18 or 20 states to entertain bills, being sure that there is an assumption of risk in the skiing sport. Now, you're familiar, I'm sure, to some extent with the history of assumption of risk in Oregon. We used to have it. And then the legislature, in its wisdom, came along and said no more assumption of risk. How far that extended was always an open question. There are a couple cases in the Oregon Supreme Court where it specifically leaves open the question of a specific consent and assumption to whatever you're doing in a written document, probably. And the Oregon court has said that it possibly leaves open the loophole of assumption of risk in sports. Now, that's the status of the law at the present time in Oregon.
That was an Oregon case, not a Washington case.
No, it's Oregon. I don't have the citation with me. I'd gladly give it to you. I think Representative Lombard has it. So when we tried this case in January, we succeeded in getting the trial court to give an instruction on assumption of risk of the things that are inherent to the sport. The defense won in that case. The case is now on appeal. We're getting ready. We just got the transcripts. We're getting ready to write the briefs and so on. And the effort in this bill is to clarify the law in Oregon by having the legislative edict that assumption of risk in the sport of skiing remains. Now that's the essence of what we're trying to do in this total bill.
See, if that's
what the bill said, and if that's what I got out of it, I wouldn't have much problem with that. That isn't what the bill says, and it adds to that a 180-day statute.
Well, let me go on and explain the other elements of the bill, if I may. As Representative Lombard explained to you, the original bill was a so-called Washington-type bill, which was extremely complex and complicated, and I agreed with Representative Lombard initially that that was true. So I undertook to revise the thing completely. I can advise this subcommittee that other states have now taken our bill and are now using it and feeling that it is the type of bill that should be used for whatever value that may have. We go ahead with the assumption of risk and the inherent risks. That's the primary purpose of the bill. Then the question came along about notice. Now, I can tell this subcommittee from my personal experience for 3.5 years that where some of these cases are brought to the court 1 year and 9 months after the incident occurs, it has been utterly impossible at times and extremely difficult at other times to find the people that were involved on the day in question. Just extremely difficult. And in some cases, we just can't find them.
Is it any more difficult for the operator than it is for the plaintiff?
Well, the plaintiff is the one that gets hurt. He knows what happens. He's got his friends. He's got his names or whatever it may be at the time that it happens. The ski area doesn't even know that it happens. Now, if the person is injured, and if the person is responded to by the ski patrol, they make out a form that indicates the time that it happened and so on. That's notice to the area. No question about it. I've got one case right now. A fellow falls down. He rented some skis. He fell down. He went down. His leg was hurting him a little bit. And he didn't say a word to anybody about it until he sued 1.5 years later. We have no knowledge of the event. We don't know anybody that knows anything about it. The skis that he rented have now disappeared. We have no way to check on what he's alleging. Now, that's the problem that's involved. In this trial that we had in January, we had to bring in 5 people from all over the United States, and we had to run one of them down. We even hired an investigating agency to run him down. It was that difficult. So the purpose of this is to give notice to the ski area. Now, we already have it in our statute, as you know, in municipal liability. This is notice of the injury. If the person has already given notice, if the ski area knows about it, if the patrol has made out a report, that all satisfies that. If the individual is in some incapacitated condition so that he can't do this for 180 days, that's an exception in here. And at the insistence and with our concurrence, assistance of the trial lawyers and our concurrence, it was provided here specifically that the ski area shall give notice of this requirement so as to give the person a fair shot. All we're trying to do is to get notice. This has nothing to do with the statute of limitations for bringing an action if the notice is there. Now, that's what that part is about. We get to Section 4, the duties of the skiers. If you were to examine the 15 or 20 bills that are before the legislatures of various states, and I think Representative Lombard has most of these, you will find in most of them the so-called rules of the road for skiers. Now, this is put in here as a basic process of educating the skier, because there are so many of them up there that don't know what they're doing. And this causes injury to other people. Take just as an example, this one, skiers must wear retention straps or other devices to prevent runaway skis. Now, anybody that skis recognizes that that probably should be done. If you fall down, your ski comes off and it goes racing down the hill, you can injure somebody severely. These retention straps hold the ski so that it won't run away. But some people don't pay any attention to it. Now, the ski areas can list all of these things on a board and say to the skiers, hey, look, these are the things that you ought to do. And when you cut in on somebody going down a hill, you should give way to him. He's got the right of way over you. The ski areas can put that on a board and put it up there. and they've done it to some degree already, and the thought was here, if this was put into ORS as a rule of the road of skiers, then when that board goes up there, it can state, the law of the state of Oregon requires so-and-so. It'd be just that much more emphatic as far as education of the skier is concerned.
Representative Mason, do you have any hobbies besides skiing?
Pardon?
Do you have any other hobbies besides skiing?
Well, I used to ski, and I have bilateral hip implants now, and I can't ski anymore.
Okay.
Yes, I golf, used to play badminton.
Would it offend you if you went out to the golf course, and you look up, and there's a sign there, it says, Oregon law says, thou shalt not tee off until the party in front of you is at least, not a golfer, 200 yards away. Would that offend you?
I can hit the ball 200 yards.
Would that offend you if you, as a golfer, saw Oregon law says thou shalt not, would that offend you?
Well, let's put it this way. If the legislature in its wisdom should decide that the rules of the road should not be put in the legislative enactment, I'm sure the ski areas will attempt to impose this kind of a rule of the road as an education process for the skiers. It will not have as much effect on the skiers as it would be if it's listed in this manner.
Well, I'm trying to get to my basic point that just some things are inappropriate in law. For instance, let's say you are a trap shooter. And you show up at the local trap club, Salem Gun Club out here, and there's a sign that says, Oregon law says thou shalt not
shoot across the road.
Load your gun until you're at your station to shoot. Everybody knows that. There are rules, usually club rules, right there telling you to do that. I would not find it unusual to find these posted, but doesn't it bother you that this Oregon statute get that involved in your life?
No, it doesn't. We already have that in so many areas. There's a law now, you can't shoot your gun across the road.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other, you can't shoot it so far away from the road and things of that nature. In almost every area of life that we have, we do have the intervention of government, no question about it. Now, this is not made a crime to do these things. And like I say, if the legislature in its wisdom should decide that this is an undue imposition, I'm sure the ski areas can put it up anyway, but the purpose of this was to try and help the other skiers who are getting injured from people not responding to this kind of common sense. Now, these things that are in here, if you look at them carefully, and anybody that skis will recognize that everything in here is a statement of common sense. But unfortunately, there are a lot of people that don't reply to common sense approach. And we were trying in this manner to emphasize these are the things that you ought to do to keep from injuring somebody else. These are not for the benefit of the ski area, Representative.
Okay, let me ask you a very pointed legal question
mm-hmm.
then. Can you tell me on the record here that you'll never ask bring a motion to dismiss, a motion for non-suit, or a jury instruction ever based on any of these things in Section 4?
I would assume that these things, if somebody, well, let's just take, for example,
the
retention
statute. That's a pretty simple question. Will you ever?
No, I don't think it is. In the first place, I'm not the only one that's going to do it. There are going to be other lawyers. I would assume that if I was defending somebody who got hit by a runaway ski, I would ask the judge to instruct the jury, the Oregon law requires the skiers must wear retention straps or other devices to prevent runaway skis. If you find that the defendant was not wearing such a device and that proximately contributed to the injury, then you can consider that same way of the rule, failing to give the right of way on the rule of the road. Same thing.
So while they're not criminal, they do have quite the force of law.
It's a rule of the road. That's right. Am I explaining this the same way you understood it, Representative Lombard?
Yes, I think so. I think the analogy that we felt was appropriate was to the rules of the road of vehicular traffic and not to just a golfing pursuit or a basketball game or something like that, where you have large numbers of people
in movement, and you've got basically a lot of movement that that an area operator doesn't have, or the owner of the premises doesn't have control over, that it is very appropriate to have statutory rules of the road. And it was just the feeling of the Senate that in this case it was appropriate to have these rules of the road and also to put them in the statutes. And it, I think, was recognized, I think, in answer to your question, Representative Mason, that if in any situation a jury instruction would be called for, that it would be expected. Similarly, again, to jury instructions dealing with rules of the road in vehicular traffic. So that, I think, was the more appropriate analogy. And again, I can only reiterate, and of course we could take this committee's time and bring these people down, but we had at least two hearings before the Senate Agriculture Committee, large numbers of skiers, the potentially injured parties, the affected persons who came and agreed that yes, we ought to have statutory rules of the road in this sport. I think your question is valid as to, where do you and where do you not embody in statutes rules of activity, rules of control, and what have you. And I think you simply have to look at the activity, number of people involved, what the activity is, and so forth. I don't think anybody would suggest that you ought to post the country club or any golf course an ORS sign that says that that you can't that you cannot drive with people in sight within 200 yards or something like that. But
Are there any other cases that you can think of other than those involving motorized vehicles where a legislature has regulated recreational conduct?
Boating.
Is that true with respect to sailboats, or is that true with respect to motorized vehicles?
Well, you have, for instance, by federal regulation, rules of the inland road and international rules that deal with boating and right-of-way and navigation deal with boats and sailboats, and differentiate between craft under sail and craft under power.
Are those state laws, or is that...
Those happen to be primarily
navigable water. Navigable water.
Those happen to be primarily federal laws, but I think boating, which is certainly a recreational activity in the truest sense of the word, is one. Vehicular traffic is another. I don't know, Darrell, are you aware of any of that?
Mr. Chairman, if I'm not representing myself. Well, all these... the analogy here kind of it's become strange because the boating and the vehicular traffic all have to do with public highways, and here we're regulating some recreational activity on the private land.
No, may I beg to differ with you? You're regulating public highways.
Mr. Johnson, I think that when the Senate Agriculture Committee adopted this, I don't think they were quite cognizant of what that, although it's the explanation has been given here that the ski areas are going to be able to post these things, and that's what we focused on. But as an attorney, when you start saying jury instructions, and I start saying motions for non-suits based on statutory provisions, I don't see some polite little notification. I see some pretty high caliber legal, some pretty big legal ammunition here that we're giving. Putting that right in the statute, because the jury instructions are going to come based on this statute, and the motions for non-suit are going to come based on this statute.
If you will examine these portions, Representative Mason, you'll find that most of these are aimed at the protection of the other skiers. They have nothing to do with the protection of the ski area. They're aimed at protecting the other skiers. I suffered the same thing. I was going downhill and somebody cut right in front of me, and I tried to get out of the way, and I got a broken leg out of it. I've personally suffered from these things. I know what it is. And these are aimed at helping the other skiers. It's not aimed at helping the ski area. This is for, you have thousands of people coming down these hills. Some of them, when they know what they're doing, they can follow a given path. You get somebody up there that doesn't know what he's doing, and you don't know what path he's going to follow. And he may run into you or across you or anything. And they're trying to educate the skiers.
Mr. Johnson, excuse me. I noticed the time is 9:30. We have to go into session at 10. There's two other witnesses on this bill, and I'd like to hear them. And then we have another bill for which people have come.
Was there any other question you people had that I could respond
to? Well, I would like you to, if we can do this, and I don't mean to cut you short, but we spent much more time on this bill than I ever expected, and as I said, people have come a long ways to testify on the other bill. We'd like to accommodate them. If you could give us about 1 minute justification for the 180 days, I'd like to hear that. And I'd like to have Dr. Allen and Mr. Conkling give us about 5 minutes of testimony so that we can move on into the other.
Well, can I ask one question that's really important? As a matter of statutory construction, Section 2 says that the skier assumes the inherent risks insofar as they are reasonably obvious, expected, or necessary. Do you think that qualifier, insofar as they're
no,
obvious,
I don't think I'm following you. Section 2 what?
Section 2 says that the skier assumes the inherent risks of skiing insofar as they are reasonably obvious, expected, or necessary.
Yes.
All right, so the qualifier presumably leaves some liability with the ski area operator.
Oh, surely.
As a matter of statutory construction, does that override the policy statement that says no person shall recover damages from a ski operator for injuries resulting from those inherent risks?
The discussion in the subcommittee, which you will find on tape, was that by putting in the reasonably obvious, expected, or necessary, was to leave it to the jury to determine what was an inherent risk and what wasn't an inherent risk.
But inherent risk is defined quite specifically.
No, those are merely illustrations that you will find in Section 1. Inherent risks are include but are not limited to, and gives those examples of it that are there as being the possible inherent risks. But it still leaves it open as to those that are reasonably obvious, expected, or necessary.
Mr. Johnson, I think we've indicated to you some of the problems that we see with the bill. One of the things that your testimony has brought out to me is that these duties, which I originally interpreted to be duties of the skiers vis-a-vis the slope operators, now are really rules intended to apply among skiers. And I wonder what they're doing in this bill, which has an entirely different purpose. And why they are mixed in with these other duties. It would strike me that a better form of organization might be to separate those kinds of duties out. So
when the original testimony was given, there were people that had skied for 30 years, 25 years, 40 years that came and testified, and they were all in favor of something of this nature to help in the education of the new skiers.
Right. Well, all I'm saying is that we have duties of skiers vis-a-vis operators mixed in with duties of skiers with respect to other skiers, you see. And it initially, frankly, it confused me. Your testimony has brought that out and underscored that for me.
If you will look, you will notice that there are two or three of the subsections in there that are obviously beneficial to the ski area.
Right.
And then this is the way that the other states had done it. And to that extent, we followed what the other states have done.
I appreciate that. Oregon, as you know, is always unique and independent and different.
I would be happy if any of you have any question to respond in writing or orally at any further period that you might want.
Okay, I think you've seen some of the questions we've highlighted.
Mr. Johnson, could you put together for the committee as possible amendment a commensurate duties of the ski area operators that we can put it in Section 6?
Well, I was going to comment on that. If you were to read the permit that these people operate under,
I realize
the government,
that,
it's all there.
Yeah,
could you put together a list?
No, I did not.
I mean, but could you do that?
Well, it all depends on what you want in there on the part of the ski area operators. There are literally dozens of things you can put in, but they are all pretty well set forth in the requirements of the federal government.
Oh,
Well, I mean, I think it's some of the feeling of some of the committee here that if we're going to have a list of duties for skiers, we should have a list of duties for the ski off.
If somebody would indicate those that they want, I would be glad to put them in an appropriate form. I don't know which ones you want.
Maintenance of the slopes, maintenance of the lifts.
Which is already required of them now. That's the part that came out in the other hearing. I think Representative Lombard can show you that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. Dr. Allen and Mr. Conkling, would you like to come up together? Would that be convenient for you? Or are you? I apologize for the time constraints, but as you see, we're always operating against deadlines, and we've used up a lot of time on this bill.
Who would you like to go first?
Whichever of the two of you.
I'll just put it. You go ahead and I'll fill in.
Okay. Yeah. My name is Richard Allen. I'm the president of the Mount Hood Ski Patrol. I have been skiing on Mount Hood since 1951. I've been a ski patrolman since 1966. And so I think I do speak with some experience in regards to skiing. My only purpose in coming here today is to let you know that the Mount Hood Ski Patrol, who is very much involved in skier safety, does support this bill which you're considering. The Mount Hood Ski Patrol is a volunteer group of people. We're not in the employ of the area operator. We work as a triumvirate, in essence, with the Forest Service, the area, and ourselves to provide advanced first aid and rescue capability to the areas for rescuing the skiers. Naturally, we're interested in skier safety. We would just assume there were never any ski accidents. It would certainly make our job a lot easier. But we do feel that as a group, there is an inherent risk in skiing. And as any of us who are skiers can tell you, every time you put on your skis, there is some risk, and that the areas we do feel do a very capable job and are responsible to the needs of skiers in terms of marking hazards and so on. But with weather, the way it changes, et cetera, it becomes a totally impossible task to always mark every hazard, to always have everything just the way you would want it. So the Ski Patrol does support this bill, and we would hope that you would act favorably upon it. Ray?
Thank you very much.
I'm Ray Conkling from Portland, Oregon. Though over the years I've worn many hats in the skiing areas, recreation-wise, the people I represent today are the Pacific Northwest Ski Instructor Association and the members of that group. We have some 4,000-plus ski instructors in the PNSIA, which is the largest ski instructor organization in the United States. A number of things, and I'll try to avoid the redundancy effort through past testimony, but the ski instructor group itself is concerned with many things in the ski area, in the area of skiing, and with the people that they teach and work with. We have a safety code per se within the Ski Instructor Association. It's something that we practice continually with the people that we work with and teach on the hill. Not everybody takes skiing lessons. Some are just freelance, attend the area of their choice whenever they want, ski free. Free meaning not cost-wise, but without taking lessons or being involved with some other organized group. Ski magazines, all of the publications reflect ski safety continuously, month after month through the season. Many people read this. The area operators continuously post safety programs. You folks, and apparently the American Standard Association is unfamiliar to many of you fellows, but that happens to be a particular situation in all industry. And if you look at the federal regulations, it pretty well points out what the responsibilities are on federal lands and on public lands and within industries that the government has set up. But at any rate, ski instructors practice safety with their people, and the entire association is in favor of the bill for a number of reasons. I guess a big part of it is insurance costs. a lot of instructors, some are employed directly by the ski area on a full-time basis, but most ski instructors are part-time, like myself, have other jobs or businesses, and we do this on the weekend. Many ski schools and instructors find it impossible to acquire insurance, or that that is available is extremely high and adds to the cost of the skiing program. Area operators find that insurance costs for them are high when relating to ski instructor groups. Sometimes difficult in many areas to acquire insurance at all. So that increases the cost to the skiing public. And we're interested in economics in this whole thing. We're interested in areas that are providing jobs for personnel, that are paying taxes into communities. We're interested in the type of management of those lands. We're interested in the full-time instructor that gets paid and pays taxes. And so costs are reflected to the skiing public. The assumption of risk, and I've spent most of my life in athletics, I've always assumed, whether I played football, basketball, baseball, skiing, track, whatever the situation might be, that whatever I did, and if I was hurt at it, and I have been, that I assumed that risk. I wasn't running around looking for someone to sue. That's the problem today. There are too many people looking for somebody to sue, even when it's their responsibility. I think to be kind of ridiculous about it, if you slip and fall in the bathtub, who are you going to sue, the Water Bureau or the maker of the bathtub?
Conkling, I've just been handed a note. I had attempted to get us excused from the session so that we could hear the testimony on the bill. I've just been handed a note that says that each of the respective parties are having a caucus on the tax plan before the session.
Cut me short. I'll wind it up.
Shorter than
All right.
I would ask you if you could just summarize
briefly. Be just a moment. The ski instructors support the bill. And nearly everyone that I know of in organized skiing supports the bill. Now, if we could have a reinstitution of total assumption of risk, I don't think this would be necessary. But unfortunately, with today's juries, today's lawyers who are looking for economic remuneration, some of the people who are not interested in working for a living are looking for people to sue, and that's the problem. All people want to know is notification in advance that something might happen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Conkling. Appreciate your testimony. Again, I apologize for the necessity of shortening it.
As far as reducing restrictions, I'd be the first to take them all off if the other side would do the same.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you. I would like now to close the hearing on Senate Bill 329, unless there's someone else who wishes to testify. Thank you. We will now have the open the hearing on Senate Bill 893, Representative Martin. Thank you, gentlemen. I want to tell the committee that the caucuses will convene shortly, and you can make up your own mind as to which where you want to be. I, frankly, would like to be in a caucus even though I'm not there still.
Let me suggest this. I suspect, first of all, the caucus is probably going to start in terms of my tentative
right after,
so we will just be kept apprised as to when they go into caucus, and if we can adjust to that. Secondly, your suggestion earlier about our being able to reconvene and continue the hearing and be excused for session, I think is good.
It's too loud.
During a period of time, possibly come back and kept apprised of the votes.
Joan, would you... Okay, would you have the caucuses notified when they have convened, so that members of the committee
pick up and remove the proposition. That's the reason.
Representative Representative Markham. Thank you for your patience.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Representative Bill Markham, Douglas, Josephine County, District 46. We're here today in support of Senate Bill 893. And let me digress very briefly. I have with me today four members of the Riddle High School DECA team that won first place honors in the anti-shoplifting competition statewide here just a few months back. They are Paula Burke, Vicki Morgan, Rachel Reichman, and on my immediate left here is Janet Wooden, who is my neighbor where I live, just west of Riddle. In fact, she's now looking after my dog on a part-time basis. We also have the instructor, Mrs. Blanche Chapman, who's the advisor to this Distributive Education Clubs of America, is the full name of it. And I'm not going to get into testimony, but I did want to just take time to introduce Janet and let the committee know that we do have a group that really worked in this area, and I'll turn it over to Janet.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Janet Wooden. I represent students from Riddle High School who won first place in a recent statewide anti-shoplifting competitive event through Distributive Education Clubs of America. I might add with pride that we placed among the top 15 in national competition on the same subject among entries from 47 states. In the course of preparing for our competitive event, we conducted extensive attitude surveys on shoplifting among grade school pupils, their parents, merchants, police, and others directly associated with this problem. We then conducted educational activities and surveyed students again to measure the results of our educational efforts. We were successful in changing attitudes. More important, during the course of our work, we discovered a major contributing factor to the incidence of shoplifting was parental attitudes about the crime. On the basis of this finding, it is my opinion that Senate Bill 893 provides a suitable and proper procedure to further reduce this crime against the community. Thank you for providing us with this opportunity. I would be happy to attempt to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Cromart?
Yeah, first of all, I'd like to congratulate you for your citizenship. I think that's a very noteworthy project that you all took on. And the fact that you won the contest shows you really put some work into it. I just wanted to ask you very briefly what kinds of attitudes you found that you could change about shoplifting and how one goes about it. Can you describe just very briefly what...
A lot of the attitudes we get from the parents is like when their kid is picked up for shoplifting and taken home, they, you know, the policeman talks to him, and then the parent just says, "Well, son, I don't want you to do that again," and they just go off again. And, you know, they're not going to do anything to the parent, so he doesn't do anything to his kid. He just tells him not to do it. If we could find some way to get the parent involved, say, give him the fine like proposed, then they'll be involved with it, and they'll be, you know, paying out something, so they're going to make their kids, you know, stay home and not go out shoplifting because they'll be getting the fine. And then when it hurts them, it's going to reflect on the kids' attitude and behavior.
Did you actually explore with them any what would happen if you imposed a fine in your attitude survey? Did you question whether a fine on the parents might make a difference?
No, we didn't actually ask them if what they thought about a fine. However, we asked them what kind of punishment they thought would be good, and we did find, I think it was almost 50% thought a fine and punishment and jailing would be appropriate.
For the child now or for the parent?
This is for the children.
Okay, we're not going to send the parents to jail.
No. They thought their parents should pay a fine, too.
Yeah. And do you think the parents, from the basis of the impressions you made in your survey, do you think that something directed against the parents that might cost money or at least require reimbursement would be effective?
Yes, because if something's going to happen to them, they're going to do something about the kid doing it as it is now. Nothing happens to them, so nothing happens to the kid. He just goes about his way.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Is there any other questions of the witness? Yes, Representative.
Janet, you say that you were successful in changing
attitudes. I'm curious, was this just by talking with the kids and getting them to realize what they were doing, or?
You mean how we changed the attitudes? Yeah, we talked a lot with the kids. We met with them several times. We had posters up. We showed a film. And we had a policeman come in and talk, and one of the stormen, Larry Linton, he had the local grocery, and he told him how that if he was, like a single candy bar was ripped off, they'd sell so many more to just replace it. And that really made a big impression on the kids, because they think, well, if we rip off the candy bar, you know, he can afford it. And this helped a lot. On the changing the attitudes, too, we were successful in. We have another local grocery store, Richard's Market, and one of our team members, Vicki Morgan, works there. And during a Saturday, they pick up sometimes up to 6 kids in the age group that we did on shoplifting. Now it's down to 2, 1, or none at all.
What items are most often shoplifted by grade school pupils? Are they candy items? Or?
Just small things they can put in their pocket, things they can take on a dare. Bubble gum, whatever.
Is there a lot of dare-type shoplifting?
Well, we found a lot of that in our community. A lot of the kids, there'd be 2 of them, and one would do the dare, and the other one would do it. The one who did it would get picked up, and the other one would take off, you know. And then the next day at school, you know, you got caught, and I didn't. Ha-ha. Big deal.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Representative Markham, did the teacher or any of the other students wish to make any brief remarks?
Well, Janet was going to kind of summarize it.
I just didn't want to deny them the opportunity because they put a lot of work into it and came a long way to tell us about it, and we appreciate that very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Markham. Otto Wilson, you want to bring your group, Otto? I think we can squeeze a 4th chair in there. I saw you had 4. Do you want to go to Keith?
We'll just start this way. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Otto Wilson. I am director of Oregon Retail Council, a division of Associated Oregon Industries. We represent a large segment of the retail industry in Oregon. Your chairman, Representative Gardner, asked that we make our presentation very concise, very brief, and that we bring only a few witnesses. We had 4, but what we'll do because of the importance of one witness is to go with just one at this time. Oregon Retail Council perhaps receives more messages from the retail community on the problem of shoplifting than any other problem that affects that industry. We have had a study underway during the past year to determine the nature of the problem and what recommendations might be made to reduce the incidence of shoplifting. One of the decisions was that it was appropriate that we adopt some type of legislation to make penalties more certain as a deterrent. We then looked about to find who was successful in such action. We found several states, but most notably our neighboring state of Washington. Senate Bill 893 is patterned after their successful statute. It then seemed appropriate, particularly before the Judiciary Committee, that we bring an attorney to talk to you here, who is the most informed expert in this field in the state of Washington. I have with me today my counterpart in the state of Washington, Mr. Bill Robinson, who is director of Washington Retail Council. I regret that his time is going to be so short because he has a wealth of information to share with you and I think can respond to your questions. We will provide to you...
Otto, that despite the shortness of the time, we will make every effort to recess the committee to come back so that we can hear you out this morning.
Thank you.
And secondly, of course, this bill, I'm sure, will go to the full committee for further resolution, so there will be another opportunity that will allow you.
But I think you can appreciate we've brought Mr. Robinson from a very busy schedule in the Washington legislature. He flew down in his own plane in order to make it quick. And we are imposing on him to quite an extent.
We'll do our very best.
We have put together between us a packet of material that is quite extensive that will provide to the whole community. to the whole committee, and it has in it a great deal of resource material that I think you will find valuable. And I'll leave all the rest of the time to Mr. Robinson.
Thank you, Otto. For the record, my name is Bill Robinson. I serve as Vice President and Counsel for the Washington Retail Council and the Association of Washington Business. Prior to that, I was a partner in a Seattle law firm. I've been involved in the civil anti-shoplifting law in Washington since early 1975, and through its amendments in 1977, and through its implementation through cooperation with the legislature and the Office of our Attorney General, who was one of the prime persons who testified in the Senate hearing on this bill. As Otto has said, that we have resource materials that go into the data, and I'm sure you don't want to be burdened with that this morning. I think it's important to point out, as the young lady referenced, that if a retailer is going to lose an item in a grocery store and he's operating on 2% profit margin, he's going to have to sell 50 items to come up with his break-even point after the loss of that item. If he's a general merchandiser on a 5% profit margin, he's going to have to sell 20 items to make up for the one that was ripped off. In addition to the direct costs to the consumer and the business, we have all the security costs, the loss prevention devices, security personnel, that kind of thing. That's part of the economic part of the problem. The social problem, I think, is perhaps maybe more of interest to some of the members of the committee, because it doesn't get discussed quite as much as it ought to. Shoplifting, although it's a crime and a form of theft, has become somewhat socially acceptable, unfortunately, in our society. And we found through our own studies that it's a middle-class crime. It's a crime committed by people that generally have the money to pay for it. And unfortunately, it doesn't have really credible consequences, especially among young people. Now, the majority of shoplifters are still adults, over 18, 60% or more. But as among them, as well as among young people, there simply are no credible consequences. So that the activity itself, instead of being regarded as antisocial, is something that becomes part of a lark. These attitudes and the burden of dealing with shoplifting, from the standpoint of law enforcement, they have the same limited resources that I'm sure you people recognize. And if it's street crime or burglary, they're going to go after that. And having been burglarized this past fall, I fully appreciate their sympathy, their sense of priorities. But in looking at those two parts of the problem, i.e. the economic and the social, the Washington law was developed with three specific policy objectives, and those were deterrence, compensation, and maintenance of involvement of the shoplifter in the criminal justice system. What I mean by that is, in terms of deterrence, the law is meant to provide a deterrent in addition to existing criminal law, not as a substitute. Secondly, it's intended to provide some sort of compensation to the retailer to defray the tremendous economic loss from shoplifting. And by economic loss, I don't mean just the item, but the cost of prevention, prosecution as well. And the third policy objective was to maintain the involvement of a shoplifter in the criminal justice system, and while still giving the retailer an affordable civil remedy. And this was perceived by our legislature to be important because you needed to identify the multiple offender. It was still a societal problem. It wasn't just a civil debt. So that law enforcement would have a track record on the individual and be able to take appropriate action if you have a multiple offender, you have somebody whose shoplifting activity is leading into some other kind of antisocial activity. Now, the key elements of the Washington law and the ones that are reflected in your Senate Bill 893 with some changes in amounts of dollars were threefold: a civil cause of action that could be brought by the retailer without respect to what law enforcement actually does, and enforce it in the same manner that any other bad debt would be enforced. Secondly, a civil penalty to be both the deterrent and a compensation.
You just
you said same manner, any of the bad debt, you still have to make your make all the elements of the crime here, wouldn't you?
That's correct. What I was simply pointing out, and I was trying to be perhaps overly brief, is that the civil cause of action, a remedy for the loss, the economic loss suffered by the retailer, something that they could bring in their own right, and where the economic penalty or amounts that are recovered are retained by the retailer rather than going to the state. I simply mean that.
Well, it just gives you a nice statutory right for conversion and gives you liquidated damages on a conversion action, doesn't it?
Not precisely.
Take what, possession with the intention of...
We have a conversion statute, we have a civil compromise statute, we have a criminal restitution statute, all of which are part of the criminal justice system, and I believe you have at least some of those comparable provisions under Oregon law. The civil cause of action was intended to provide the merchant with an affordable civil remedy where they could be assured that regardless of the local priorities with respect to the treatment of a shoplifter, the merchant could go after the shoplifter, pursue a civil remedy in the same way that we pursue any other civil claim through the courts if necessary after making a demand, and I'll get into the procedures that have been developed in that, and receive his compensation that way. Now, obviously, a civil cause of action has a lower burden of proof than the criminal system. But because of the way the law is used and because of the maintenance of the involvement through the criminal justice system, there's no practical effect on the way shoplifters are apprehended or which ones are apprehended or anything else other than existing law. The only change is what happens to them after they've been caught. There's nothing else that has changed with respect to the apprehension or detention process. If I might...
Not to interrupt you, but this, I think some of the specific questions. You see, judgments cannot be assigned. Does that mean that any actions will have to be plaintiff by the store or the counsel for the store?
That is correct. It's to avoid bounty hunting. The civil penalty provisions I mentioned was to provide both a deterrent and have both a deterrent and compensatory effect. Now, it has three elements, the elements being actual damages, a penalty in the amount of the retail value of the merchandise, and a minimum penalty of not less than $100 and under your statute nor more than $200. In addition, there are caps on liability under the Washington law of $500 and $1,000 for juveniles and adults, respectively. Under your proposed Oregon statute, they're half that amount, $250 and $500. The third key element, in addition to it being civil, having the statutory penalties, is the imposition of parental liability. The legislative precedent for that was our vandalism statutes, which have been upheld in quite a number of states. In our state, the vandalism limit is $3,000. You have an aggregate of penalties here that wouldn't exceed $700 at the most. But the reason for that, and the young lady that preceded me, I kind of summarized it. Parents were too blasé about shoplifting, and something needed to be done to get them involved, and that's what the legislature perceived was necessary, and they felt that parents should be involved, but for social policy reasons, you should exclude ward of court, foster home situations where you want to encourage a policy of taking in problem children and caring for them without the imposition of some other kind of vicarious liability.
Mr. Robinson, I grew up in a family that had a small variety store, and I've had some experience with shoplifters, and I can relate to you and the committee on any number of occasions when my store, my father apprehended children shoplifting in the store, that he was threatened with assault by their parents, threatened with all kinds of things at all hours of the days and night because their child had been apprehended shoplifting in the store. So it's not just a question of not similar responsibility. It was, we had some really ugly circumstances just because the kid ripped off a small item.
I,
I certainly appreciate that. Maybe members of the committee would appreciate just a few seconds on legislative history. The bill was sponsored by a Democrat, a leading consumer activist in our House, Representative, now Senator Lorraine Wojohn, co-sponsored by other Republican and Democratic members of the House. The bill passed virtually unanimously in 1975 from the House, went over to the Senate, where it had been heard in both the Commerce and Judiciary Committees. Leading the floor fight were Senators Pete Francis, a liberal Democrat and chairman of the Judiciary Committee from Seattle, and a conservative Republican from Mercer Island, Washington. He had tremendous bipartisan support from that standpoint. The bill needed to be amended in 1977, and you have reflected the amendment in your Senate Bill 893. The original bill said that it characterized the minimum penalty as the cost of preparing and presenting the action. And the legislature had not intended for costs to be legal costs in the sense that we normally understand those as lawyers, but rather to reimburse the merchant for the overall cost of dealing with a shoplifter. Some judges were taking the view that that meant before you were entitled to the minimum penalty, you actually had to initiate an action. And well, that wasn't the intent of the legislature at all. Therefore, in 1977, Senators Francis and Clark came back and sponsored a bill that made this concept easier to use, and that bill passed both houses unanimously. The recommended procedures on this particular bill are as follows. And these procedures, I might say, were developed by an advisory committee consisting of retailers, the Office of the Attorney General, the State Magistrates Association, the Prosecuting Attorneys Association, the Superintendent of Public Instruction, child psychologists, and crime prevention officers. It was a fairly broad spectrum of individuals and organizations on that advisory committee, and they came up with these recommendations over a two-year period. First, that the retailer continue to prosecute shoplifters through the criminal justice system and not use the civil law as a substitute. And they did that for three reasons. First, the civil law was meant to be an additional deterrent. We've found that this has been neat with respect to the attitudes of juveniles. It was kind of cool sometimes to go and shoplift because you had no real law enforcement consequences, or at least there weren't perceived to be among junior high and high school students. Yet once you had a $100 minimum penalty, it was just plain dumb to have to pay $100. And this was perceived to be a very credible consequence and had a tremendous impact on young people.
The $100 in the criminal courts? Or
no, under the civil law.
The civil remedy,
in other words, the criminal law did not provide the credible deterrent. And the young people, while they... Well, it was kind of a cool thing to dare to shoplift, and that might be something to prove yourself among your peers. It was just plain stupid to be caught and have to pay $100, or have your parents have to pay it. And we have quite a number of TV spots and radio spots featuring Lenny Wilkins and Supersonics talking about that very point, and it's been very, very effective with young people. The second aspect, or the reason for doing it in addition to the criminal, was the monetary penalties of the civil law are intended to primarily benefit the consumer and the business, who have to bear that economic burden instead of just returning them to the state. But this criminal charge reflects a societal debt that can't be wiped out by the mere payment of the civil claim. The third point, why to use both, is law enforcement needed the assurance of a merchant's cooperation if they did go after a shoplifter. They didn't want somebody coming in and say, well, you got my $100, I'm going to drop the case, not prosecute anymore. The second, once the decision is made to use this in addition to the criminal law, the second recommended procedure, this advisory group, was that the retailer sends a demand letter, much the way you would send a demand letter for any other claim against an individual before you sued them. The letter says, and we have copies of those that have been approved for use. The letter says essentially, dear Mr. or Mrs. Shoplifter, on such and such a date you took this merchandise and the amount of and the statute provides and your rights are and the amount is and please pay it within 2 weeks. If they don't, they get a second demand letter. And if they don't respond to that, the claim is brought in an appropriate court, preferably small claims court. We find that the vast majority of the cases result in payment upon immediate receipt of the demand letter. I might say that this area of how you tie the two together, the apprehension, the criminal law, and the use of the civil penalty, pose the greatest problems during the developmental phase of the use of the new civil law. What we recommend is that if a shoplifter is apprehended and the police are called and the person is taken down to the station or whatever, there is not a single mention of the civil law. No one is handed a demand letter or told that, well, now you owe us $100 or whatever they're going to claim. If they did, and some did when the law was first passed, it has the appearances of extortion, like, here you are, pay me my $100 and I might not prosecute. It's a tremendous appearance of impropriety, regardless of what the merchant actually does. So what we've recommended is that they deal with it as they do under the criminal law. After the shoplifter has left the store, then they send the demand letter. And they can get the letter, review it at home. They aren't under the stress. There's no implication that satisfaction of the civil law has anything to do with the criminal law. In fact, the contrary is explicitly stated, and they can stand on their rights at that time. And that avoids this extortion problem or the using a heavy hand of the law to get your civil penalty, and works quite well. Where a judgment is obtained, if that is necessary, and that's in less than a quarter of the cases, then it can be collected as any other claim. But you can't, as your statute also provides, have this accomplished by bounty hunters who come into the store and, in a sense, have assignment of the claims and go out and prosecute the shoplifters for percentage of the action. The legislature wanted to prohibit that particular activity, and they did, and I think rightly so. We also recommend that the retailers using this coordinate their activities with local law enforcement. I'll just take a moment to tell you what the results have been over 4 years. The first 2 years were very slow because we didn't have adequate educational materials, and we were working with the advisory committee that I mentioned to develop the appropriate methodology. My members are wildly enthusiastic about it. They have been using it, not all of them, but more and more are starting to use it in conjunction with a well-publicized anti-shoplifting campaign. It includes, by the way, the recommendation that if they're going to use this law, they have very prominent signs in their store, and they're very tasteful signs that says, this is a nice place to shop, but not to shop, and sets forth the basic provisions of the law. So that people have noticed, they don't like to be surprised about being dinged with something that they never knew existed. But beyond that, the law is publicized also through the schools, through the broadcast media, through the crime prevention programs, in conjunction with my office and the Office of the Attorney General, local organizations. And the retailers have found that use of the civil law, and to use an example, we have a test, it's a the statistical base is about 24 independent retailers. And what their experience shows, and they do not use this law all the time. By that I mean they don't have security people all the time. They're open for 84 hours a week and they have security people 30 hours a week. But what we can tell from that is there are perhaps, prior to using the civil law, 1,400 shoplifting incidences per month. That's for a fairly large volume independent retailer. The use of the civil shoplifting law after 6 to 12 months, cut the shoplifting incidences by 50%. It seemed that the 50% became an almost irreducible minimum, but it cut the 50%.
Did they indicate in dollars what that translates?
Yes, the 50% would represent the sales of $1,750 in merchandise for which that retailer would have had to sell $87,000 roughly to make up for, you know, to get back to the break-even point. It was roughly a $3,500 total shoplifting loss per month. And that cut it in half. That's in direct loss of merchandise.
And that was cut to half that.
It was cut to half that.
And how many retail establishments?
About 24. I don't have the precise number. It's a variety of drugs, a combination of drugstores and independent food retailers.
And over what period of time was that?
That's been over the last 2 years or better.
But I mean, surely they reduced their losses more than $1,700 in 2 years.
No, I'm sorry, per month. The $1,750 figure is per month. Right. I didn't make that clear. That's a per month figure. And the use of the civil law now is limited from the standpoint that you can't use it unless you catch them. And if you've got security people, you catch 1 out of 10. If you don't, you catch 1 out of 35. So if you're open for 84 hours and you have security people for 30, you're going to be catching certainly a larger percentage of your shoplifters than when you're just relying on your checkout clerks or that sort of thing. But using the civil law has had the very interesting side benefit that it's given our independent retailers an ability to compete with the chain stores that already had security personnel, and they simply couldn't afford them. But by using the civil law, they are now able to avoid part-time security, and the mere presence of that part-time security is very largely responsible for the 50% reduction in incidents. And we find further that if they stop using the civil law, that within 4 weeks, the shoplifting incidences climb up and retain their former level. And there were several test stores that did precisely that. They used it for 6 to 12 months, they stopped for 4 weeks, and then watched what happened and started up again. So it's had a tremendous deterrent effect. The compensation has given the independent retailer in particular professional loss prevention and security services that they otherwise could never have had and never have afforded, which enables them to compete better. And by the way, it's the independents who have made the primary use of this, at least in the food and general merchandising business. We do have chains like Payless and PanSave, which are using it also.
I was going to ask you what your experience has been in that regard. I remember when the federal government used to send all this money into metropolitan areas to handle burglary crimes, theft crimes. It was always upsetting to those of us who lived in rural areas just outside of those urban areas, because the effect of that was merely to push crime into the suburbs. And we always experienced a wave of increased burglary and theft whenever the federal government sent more money to Portland.
Yeah.
For the programs. And I just wondered if you had experienced that the chains were using this and pushing the shoplifting into the former.
It's worked the other way. It has had precisely the opposite effect, because the rural and suburban areas are the ones that have used it first. And they're pushing the shoplifters back to the chain stores in downtown Seattle. It's kind of interesting. The people that have been using it are, to a very great extent, are in places like Arlington and Cedar Woolley and Mount Vernon and places like this, where they've been using it for 3 or 4 years. And it seems that it takes chain stores a certain amount of time to develop their own internal programs and comfortability with a new law before they're going to implement it. So they've been coming online much later than many of the independents. I have abbreviated my remarks to some extent and would like to just respond to questions.
Questions of the witness?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Walmart.
Mr. Robinson, first of all, a general question. Have there been any constitutional challenges to the parental responsibility liability portion of this bill in the Washington experience?
Yes, there have. One was a blanket brief, not filed in a specific action, filed in the Clark County Superior Court. That brief has been responded to by an amicus brief prepared by our Attorney General, Mr. Wilson, and the packet that he has prepared for members of the committee has a full brief.
Sorry, Mr. Robinson, I've just been notified that the caucuses are now in session. We would like to go to them because they involve the tax plan. We will return here, and we would like to hear the rest of the testimony.
All right. Would you like us to...
Mr. Chairman, do you have any idea of what time span?
The word I have is that the caucus will last about 45 minutes.
That's fine for me.
My only other question, Mr. Chairman, is very short. I wouldn't need any more time, Mr. Robinson.
Fine.
Okay, so you say that in the materials you presented, the issue of the constitutional...
Yeah, we're very confident. It has been challenged and upheld in the principles in every state, in every case where it has been questioned. The only time the parental liability has ever been struck down in any statute, to my knowledge, was a Georgia statute on vandalism that had no upper limit on the parental liability.
I would simply say, Mr. Wilson knows we do have a parental responsibility law in Oregon for damage or destruction of school property, so...
Those are the most valid precedents. And we simply are extremely confident of the constitutionality, and so was Slade Gorton when he came down and testified before the Senate. Very comfortable with that. I have a summary of my remarks that I can put with these other packets.
Would you have to leave those with the clerk, and she'll see that each member of the committee gets...
And this will be in your packet. It's an extensive survey. We had the benefit of $115,000 in law enforcement assistance administration funds to help implement the law and develop the procedures, and that's why we were able to get into the psychologists and a very, very sophisticated approach to it. Then we have a manual that is used by the judges, prosecutors, defenders, lawyers, and retailers, and that includes forms and form letters, and that will also be in that packet and should be able to answer many of your other questions.
I noted reading subsection 2, paragraph 2 of section 2 of the bill with regards to parental liability. You provide that the court may waive the damages and penalty when it finds the minor child is being charged for the first time. That obviously excludes that item entitled cost of preparing and presenting the action. Is that by design?
No, that is not in the bill as it was amended by the Senate.
Do you have the A and Gross version?
I don't have the A and Gross version, yeah.
I have an additional copy of it.
Is that waiver then taken out entirely?
Yes, it is. And when that was considered in Washington, it was felt that a provision of that nature would totally destroy and gut the effectiveness of the bill. That you needed a very certain, credible deterrent that was always going to be there.
Okay, were there any other amendments to the original bill, Otto?
We changed that third penalty, as Mr. Robinson discussed with you a moment ago, when it originally had said an additional penalty for the preparation and processing costs.
Mr. Chairman, one other question then. This probably is only indigenous to Oregon and should be directed to Mr. Wilson, I think, rather than Mr. Robinson, but I note on the back page that we provide an action for recovery of damages under the section may be brought in the small claims department of the district court if total damages don't exceed the jurisdictional limit. My question is by putting in that in there, do we run the risk of having a court interpret that as an exclusive jurisdictional forum and disallowing the ability of the merchant to go into the regular side of the district court? You see, our district court jurisdictional limit is $200. Our small claims limit is $200. Secondly, not, of course, every Oregon County has a district court. In fact, most eastern Oregon counties don't. They use the justice court currently to a jurisdictional limit up to $1,000 in civil actions. And I wouldn't want to, by this language, exclude the possibility in eastern Oregon of a merchant being able to go into a justice court where there's a smaller jurisdictional limit. It's a technical question.
Well,
Representative Lombard, you can answer better than I, being an attorney, but it states that an action may be brought. And it would be my opinion that that does not exclude use of another court.
My concern is that it would not be our intention.
I
might say from our experience it might be helpful to say that it may be brought in a small claims court from the simple standpoint that we ran into an ideological problem more than a merits problem or technical problems with the bill where somebody just wouldn't want it in their small claims court. And I've spoken to two of the state meetings of our Magistrates Association on the question judicial concerns, and the experience with this law is that the small claims court system has not been overly burdened, that the adoption of
that. I'd like to encourage it.
Well, that's right. It's an inexpensive form for both the plaintiff and defendant, and we have encouraged the use of small claims court, but it does help perhaps to have it in a statute that can be brought down.
Chairman?
Yes, Representative.
A couple of quick break questions. You've been very helpful to us, and despite the fact that you may think your appearance has been truncated, it's been enormously useful to the committee, and we appreciate it. I take it that in the packet there are some materials dealing with the questions of constitutionality that might...
Yes, you were...
We'll study then.
We've got a complete brief on it, please.
All right. The second and third components are the advisory committee and the publicity campaign, and I would take it that this kind of law is not going to really fly unless you do the kinds of things that apparently you did as groundwork.
It isn't really effective, not from the public standpoint, so much as retailers won't use it unless they feel that other retailers are using it. So that's Mr. Wilson's organizational problem.
Yes.
I don't think you need a really expensive campaign. What you do need is to make sure that you have the materials developed and everyone's singing off the same sheet of music and that the posters are up in the stores. That's your public awareness. That hits the public right away. There are more people using the posters, I think, than are using the law at this point. But
yeah. Okay. Final question. The Senate amended the bill. Did they ruin it, help it, bother
it? Helped it. I think it needed the amendments or it wouldn't have been effective.
Thank you very much.
We don't always expect that from the Senate, that's why.
Mr. Chairman, what is your wish for us?
We're going to come back here.
The caucus is a half hour. They've recessed for a half hour, so we could come back a little sooner. We have to go down
Mr.
and back.
Mr. Dennis Gogolski is with us. He's security management from Payless Northwest, who has experience in both Oregon and Washington, make a comparison for you. And if you wish, we'll come back and...
We would like to hear from the remaining witnesses. Mr. Robinson, I'm advised by Representative Lombard and Frohnmayer that they have no further questions. If you wish to leave, you can. If you wish to stay, that's fine, too. But when we come back, we'll listen to the remaining witnesses.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. One other thing I wanted to say, the sequel of the story about the federal funds that went into Portland that chased all the burglars out to McMinnville was that naturally afterwards, the law enforcement people were able to claim a great reduction in the crime rate because, of course, it did happen. It often led me to wonder what would happen if they just put the notice in the paper they were going to do it and never did a thing.
Thank you.
For Bill, we will resume the reconvene the meeting, and Mr. Robinson, I understand that Joan Robinson has a question for you.
Okay. On the vandalism statute that you're comparing this to, the parental liability stuff, do they make the parents liable for punitive damages also? And are they penalty statutes or is it just the value of
the... There are both kinds. And the brief that is provided in those materials cites, I think, a dozen or so statutes with varying kinds of language, all of which have been upheld. The only one, as I mentioned, that has not been upheld. Now, clearly, there are clearly statutes that impose penalties or sums of money that are beyond actual damages, you know, among those dozen or so statutes referenced. And as I indicated, the only one that has ever been struck down, the parental liability area, it's relevant here anyway, is one where it had no limit. You know, the parents are liable for their juvenile's destruction of a nuclear power plant or something.
Okay, also, I mean, it seems I have no problem at all with requiring parents to pay for the value of the merchandise. It's only the penalty part that bothers me.
Well, I might comment on that. The value of the merchandise is absolutely inconsequential in many of these cases. The tremendous cost is not in the value of the merchandise, it's in the time of the merchant, the managerial time, the prosecutorial expense, and just that is the real cost burden. Plus, when you talk about the value of the merchandise, you have to insert there perhaps two multipliers to get the real economic impact. The first multiplier is that for the one you caught, if you've got professional security, nine got away. And of course you got to pay for the security. And if you don't have professional security, for the one you caught, 34 got away. Now for each of those incidences that got away, you've got to sell anywhere from 20 to 50 of that, you know, whatever that item is or the dollar value of it to make up to the break-even point. So that is what sparked the legislation, that the existing economics didn't work.
Nevertheless, philosophically, it bothers me to punish one person for the crime of another.
No, I think if the minimum penalty were $500, then I think you might be saying that. But I think from the time involvement of our retailers right now, I seriously question whether $100 is adequate to deal with the one individual. It isn't paying for the cost necessarily in all those that got away. It just helps appreciate the economic consequences. But when you start adding up a manager's time and the hassle of dealing with the shoplifter and then the prevention that's oriented towards that individual shoplifter as well as others as a class, then the $100 is hardly adequate.
Thank you, Mr. Roberts. We have next to hear from Otto Wilson, Dennis Kowalski, and Russell McMurdy.
Mr. McCurdy had a hearing in ag and decided that he would just leave word that he endorses the proposal on behalf of Safeway Store.
Very good. That's some of the best testimony we have sometimes. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Dennis Kowalski, Corporate Security Manager for Payless Drugstores Northwest Incorporated. I'll make this very brief, since Mr. Robinson has done such an outstanding job on his presentation and has covered more than almost all the ground. Payless Drugstores operates 80 retail outlets in four states, Oregon, Washington, California, and Idaho. For those 80 stores, we have a security staff of security officers and supervisors at number 70. Our budget for the year 1978 amounted to $1,120,000. This budgetary expenditure was excluding the cost of loss in approximately 60% of our stores, which cost about $30,000 apiece, as well as offices in all of our stores, which cost $5,000 additionally. So as you can see, the expenditure for security at Payless Drugstores Northwest is considerable. I might add at this point that the reason why we are so much in support of this bill is primarily because of the benefit that it not only avails us, but the small retailer who does not have our resources. And I think this is something that's got to be considered very carefully. We have, as I said, a security force of 70 people. And over the 5 years that we have, or I should say the 8 years that we have had a security staff in operation in our stores, we've apprehended over 50,000 people in our chain-wide operation. That has failed to stem the tide of shoplifting, and it's ever increasing year after year at about the rate of 20% for our chain. One would obviously be able to extrapolate from that the fact that if we can't stem the tide of shoplifting, the small retailer is obviously at the absolute mercy of the people who visit his shop from day to day. We have also experienced a number of frustrations in taking the shoplifters that we do apprehend, those that we do prosecute through the criminal justice system because of the time and expense involved. Again, because of our resource, we have been able to mount a significant effort to make sure that this is achieved. But again, the small retailer is left at odds because he can ill afford to close up his shop for a day to go down, sign a complaint, go back to his shop, close down another day to go and testify against the individual that he's arrested. I think it's important to note also that this law is a very practical piece of legislation. If it is enacted into law, it will be very practical insofar as it places the burden of the crime directly upon the perpetrators of it, the shoplifters themselves, something that we don't have a very good opportunity to do in many of the other crimes that society is faced with today. Obviously, one could say that there are degrees of justice, and in this particular arena, the degree of justice is 100% because you have a one-on-one situation. The victim and the perpetrator, whether it be a criminal or a civil proceeding, hashing over the facts to reach an ultimate determination. Of course, in a civil proceeding, being associated with the criminal as kind of an adjunct, it adds a certain amount of impact over and above that which a criminal proceeding alone would have, because it doubly drives home the point. First of all, it is against the criminal statute, and secondly, it is also against the civil statute, which basically says that it's against your neighbor, and your neighbor has a right of recourse that he could pursue in holding you responsible for your actions or the actions of the child. Our prior experience in this particular area, dealing primarily with Washington under RCW 420-4230, has indicated that in the area where we have most of our operating resources, in the King County area that surrounds Seattle, that we have experienced a 40% reduction in shoplifting in our stores over the period of time that this law has been in effect. This is quite significant for us. It's something that I personally did not think could be achieved when this law first went into effect. I'm rather cynical in that respect. But I've been made a believer in this law for the simple fact that statistics in this particular respect do not lie. As you well know, it probably is somewhat of a disappointment to me to have to say that, for the simple reason that ever-increasing amounts of shoplifting assure my employment. And the fact that a drop in this particular area is somewhat distressing to me in that respect. But it kind of, it's offsetted by the fact that I'm satisfied to see that there is at least something now that's having a positive impact on this particular crime. I would like to close simply by saying that, as I said earlier, I believe this to be a practical piece of legislation insofar that it does have dramatic effect on the crime itself. It does place the burden of responsibility on the people who should bear it, the perpetrators of the crime. And it gives the retailer, both large and small, the ability to pursue the individual and at least recoup a percentage of the costs that are expended in having to bring the action about. And I say a percentage of the cost. Mr. Robinson alluded to that. I can assure you if an individual is, if a suit is filed against an individual for $100, it barely does compensate us for the cost of forwarding the action, for the simple reason that in our particular area, apprehensions are made by security officers, and as a matter of course, the prosecution is determined, they are turned over to police. That's the first individual involved. That individual must spend considerable time in detecting, monitoring the activities of, and ultimately making the stop of the shoplifter after the commission of this crime. They then have to interview the individual at a considerable expenditure of time, call the police, wait for their response, and go through the necessary paperwork to assure that a prosecution is instituted, such as signing of the complaint. From that point, the matter is deferred to the corporate security area, where we make a determination on who we file on. We must take the time to determine who the cases are filed against, and consequently, that also takes a certain amount of time, along with the fees of registered mail, so on and so forth. Ultimately, there will be a court appearance by the security officer to forward the criminal action, and quite possibly, in collecting under this particular provision, a court appearance by us as well in the civil arena to collect in that respect. So $100 is not a significant amount when you're considering the fact that that much time and effort has been expended to forward a case. At this point, I'll simply say that I strongly urge that you pass this measure for the simple fact that it is practical legislation and very effective at that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Any questions? If not, we'll adjourn the meeting. Thank you very much.